TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Fire and Forest Ecology, Questions and Answers. Chad Hansen and Monica Bond. In June 2021, John Horning, Executive Director of the Wild Earth Guardians, moderated a webinar on the life-affirming functions of fire and forests. Also discussed were the problems caused by thinning and post-fire logging promoted by the Forest Service and even subsidized by congressional mandates. All this while so many of us are waking up to the urgent need to preserve and protect forests, not just for their beauty and complexity, but also for their power to absorb and sequester carbon dioxide and protect us from climate collapse. Here's John Horning.
We wanted to start this conversation by really celebrating the dynamic and restorative role of fire and even challenge some of our perception that is driven in the media and by agencies about fire, talking about the narrative and the dimensions of flow from it, that wildfire is a disaster and it's always a disaster. Let's start with kind of the political and cultural pressures that influence the agency in terms of how they respond to wildfire. You want to start, Monica? Just provide the context for what the agencies are responding to.
Yeah, I think because really the dominant paradigm still is the good fire, bad fire paradigm, which is that the big severe fires are the bad fires that we need to stop. And we can try to stop this through lighting prescribed fires and then also doing thinning in the forest. And I think this is one of the myths we need to bust here tonight or today. So that's still the pervasive dominant paradigm. And unfortunately, underneath it all, it's really supported by, you know, and it's driven by economics, because the Forest Service makes most of its money on timber sales through, you know, these days with these post-fire salvage logging sales or thinning green trees in the name of preventing fire. And so a lot of it is really, you know, the underlying dynamics are for financial purposes. And I also have to say that I think part of the problem as well in being able to kind of change the paradigm to one of, you know, not good fire, bad fire, but that bad fire is when it burns down your home or your community, but it's not when it burns out in the forest miles away from a community. It's actually good and restorative for many, many species. And I think part of the problem is sometimes our own brains can't even wrap our heads around that idea. And especially, I think sometimes some people who maybe work for the agencies where for so long they have believed, and it's kind of this entrenched belief that these fires are bad, that being presented with data to the contrary, their brains just aren't necessarily accepting. And it's interesting because I think there's a lot of psychological studies that actually bear this out, that sometimes people kind of dig their heels in even to a prior belief, even when they're faced with data to the contrary, because it's really almost part of their identity now. You know, Smokey Bear, fire's bad. And so it's like they kind of dig their heels in and sort of believe their prior beliefs even more than ever. And this is something that we have to overcome to be able to change that paradigm and to embrace the beauty and the importance, critical ecological importance of these fires.
Yeah, we've seen that psychological dynamic you've described on climate issues and the way in which people's pre-existing beliefs tend to reinforce their worldviews, notwithstanding the facts.
Yeah.
Chad,
yeah.
You've had a long career in these issues. Could you just speak to political and cultural context in which the wildfire as disaster narrative, like what the implications of that narrative are?
Yeah, I think, you know, Monica said something I think is profoundly important, you know, in terms of the good fire, bad fire, and what really is the catastrophe. You know, we need to rethink how we view wildfires out in the forest, but it's very different when a fire affects a community. So for example, you know, an example I talk about a lot is the Camp Fire of 2018 that devastated the town of Paradise in the northern Sierra Nevada. A lot of people don't realize, you know, that fire, which was ultimately 150,000 acres in size, most of the area that it ultimately burned through was forest that, you know, hadn't been really managed in the past. It had very little logging history or no logging history. That fire was overwhelmingly low and moderate intensity. But the first 6 hours of that fire, it burned through some of the most heavily logged forest in the entire Sierra Nevada, on both national forest land and private timberland. There was a fire that burned 10 years earlier called the Butte Complex that had been heavily post-fire logged on public lands and private lands, a lot of commercial thinning as well, across these thousands and thousands of acres that just happened to be right between the point of origin and the town of Paradise. And the fire burned across those logged areas faster than anywhere else that it burned in the entire fire. I mean, far faster. And it moved about 3 miles an hour across those logged areas, whereas in the rest of the fire, it crept at just a tiny fraction of 1 mile per hour. What that meant was people had very little time to evacuate. And the fire reached that town very, very quickly. 85 people lost their lives, in part because of that pre-fire logging. Of course, it was hot, dry, windy conditions. So the fire was going to reach the town no matter what, because the wind was blowing in that direction, but it wouldn't have got there as quickly. And in addition, over 14,000 homes were lost. The reason for that is that the town, the people in the town were told by the Forest Service, by the logging industry in the years prior to the fire, that those logging projects were fuel reduction. Removing the dead trees was fuel reduction. Removing the forests were overgrown, they said, so they were going to remove a bunch of live trees, and that would reduce fuel and create open park-like forest conditions, and that would save them from fire. And people thought, well, those logging projects out there over the ridge, they'll save us. I don't need to put on that fire-resistant roofing. I don't need to spend $300 at Home Depot and put on modern ember-proof vents to keep those flaming embers from being driven by the winds into my old attic vent. I don't need to get the dry pine needles and leaves out of my rain gutters and put on rain gutter guards. I don't need to do defensible space pruning within 100 feet of my home. People didn't do that. And the consequences were absolutely tragic. And that was catastrophic from a human impact standpoint. But the fire itself, people don't talk about this, but outside of that several thousand acres that was heavily logged, the fire was a classic mixed intensity fire, if anything, at the low end on the intensity scale.
Isn't that amazing? I got another question here that relates to this. The Forest Service is telling the American public that we need to not only fight fires, but the way to address this is to log our forests. And again, this is something that really irks me. And there's a Forest Service researcher by the name of Jack Cohen, who either came up with this quote or I saw it in a story. And it's this simple: we can't fireproof our forests, but we can fireproof our homes and our communities. And I think, you know, the Forest Service is doing something quite destructive by propagating this misinformation and myth instead of the billions of dollars that they're devoted. I'm sorry, I'm on a little rant here, and I said I wouldn't do this.
Go for it.
So, no, just
100%.
Yeah, I mean, what are your thoughts about how we confront these myths and get more and more communities to embrace that we must fireproof our communities, because we can't fireproof our forests?
Yeah, I mean, when you look at so many of these measures proposed by federal agencies and bills in Congress, so much of it is to continually pour money into doing these logging projects out in remote areas, as if that's what's going to help with this fire situation. By fire situation, I mean people's homes burning and, you know, the catastrophic effect in a community, in a home. And so it's really just diverting much needed money that we absolutely could use to absolutely effective measures, to home hardening and protecting communities, having community emergency plans to leave, but also, you know, hardening your homes and your areas around the town. And the thing that I like about this message we're all talking about today is it's a really positive one. It's like, let's focus our attention on protecting our homes and communities, and then we can celebrate when it burns out in the forest because it's creating this great habitat for so many species. It's like a freeing feeling almost. And and I agree 100%. I just think it's very, very, very damaging on the part of the Forest Service and members of Congress when they try to say the solution is logging out in the forest. It absolutely isn't, and people are going to die unless we focus our attention back on what works to help people.
Chad, what would you add?
I mean, I think Monica said it really well. I'll just add a couple of things. You know, there's really good research that's been done by, you know, Dr. Cohen, who you mentioned, also Dr. Alexandra Seifert and her colleagues, they've kind of written the book on this issue about how you protect homes and communities from wildfire. And what Dr. Seifert, for example, has found, and Dr. Cohen's research resonates with this, is that beyond 100 feet from homes, there's no additional benefit to vegetation management.
Yeah.
None. And so it's really about the home itself and 60 feet or sometimes as much as 100 feet from the home. And it's not about cutting mature trees. It's about limbing up the lower limbs and removing dry grasses and twigs and some seedlings and pruning, basically. It's light touch pruning. You need to do it every single year. That's what defensible space is. And then making the home fire safe, what we call home hardening. There's a few key things that need to be done. Ember-proof vents, rain gutter guards, get those dried pine needles and leaves off the roof every fire season. Simple things. When those things are done, and we have numerous examples, I talk about a lot of them in my smokescreen book. When those things are done, what we're seeing is frequently over 95% of homes will survive, even in the most intense fire. And we're seeing numerous examples now where 99% or more of the homes will survive. And so we know this is effective. What we're seeing right now are proposals from Congress. We're seeing it in California as well, at the state legislature, to do what they're calling the all of the above approach, because they know they have to pay lip service to community protection. But what they're doing generally is allocating about 2 or 3% of the funding that they're proposing to home hardening and community protection from wildfires. And then 97-98% of the wildfire funding is just basically to increase logging out in the forest. So here's the problem. Again, it's not helping. It's not stopping weather-driven and climate-driven fires, because weather and climate are the main factors that drive forest fires, of course. But also, there's a growing body of research that's showing that in most cases, logging, including commercial thinning, makes fires burn hotter and faster most of the time, oftentimes toward towns. So you can always find, the fires are highly variable. You can always find a stand where a logged area or a thinned area burned at low intensity. And the Forest Service and the logging industry have been, finding those examples and highlighting them in a misleading fashion for many years. But what people need to understand is those are the exceptions, not the rules. I'm doing research on the big 2020 fires, and I'm finding the same thing. The thinned areas burned a lot more intensely most of the time than the unthinned areas.
They're saying that they're solving the problem, but in fact, everything is indicating that what they're doing is worsening the problem. So I actually want to get to some questions from the audience. This one's from Patty McClelland, and just either one of you jump in when you hear it. So I live on the Front Range in Colorado. We are aware of the climate crisis. Are you suggesting, as we watch our state burn, that it is all natural or okay?
I'd be happy to jump in first. I'm sure Monica's got thoughts. Yes, ecologically, we do not have an excess of fire in Colorado. We still have a deficit, although Colorado is closer than some states to natural pre-suppression levels. So, as long as we're within the natural range of variability, then, we shouldn't see fire as a disaster. And the same thing goes, by the way, for areas where we have, large patches of snag forest created by drought and native bark beetles. These are native beetle species, in many ways are the cornerstone of the entire ecosystem. And what we're finding is that the unburned snag forest created by drought and native bark beetles are similar in biodiversity to the burned snag forest, the ones that are created by high intensity fire. They're both incredibly ecologically rich. I talk about this in the chapter 2 of my smokescreen book. There's a lot of research on this. And so those areas in like Colorado's forests, where you have significant stands of snag forest created by drought and bark beetles, those areas are ecological treasures too. And interestingly, the science is showing that forests with a lot of dead trees also do not burn more intensely. In fact, they often burn less intensely. Same thing with really dense forests. They burn less intensely most of the time. So really much of what we've heard about forests and fire is just incorrect based on the most recent research.
Yeah, and I might also add too that if we even step further back in time, we're sort of talking here a bit about maybe the last 100 years or so. And Chad, you mentioned that we actually have a deficit of fire in a lot of our forests. If you look at some of the research that's been done looking way back in time, there was a study in 2004 published in the journal Nature, Pierce et al., where they actually looked back over 8,000 years in Yellowstone Park and also in Idaho, and they basically mapped or they just quantified the amount of fire going back all that time. And there was far more fire in the forests in these areas than there was presently. Especially about 1,000 years ago, there was something called the medieval climactic anomaly, and there was just an order of magnitude more fire, more big fires and just more fires all across the landscape. So yeah, I mean, I agree with Chad. It's entirely natural to have this happen, and it's really tracks with climate.
Fascinating. I still want to honor some of the emotional dissonance around the experience of fire and the displacement that occurs, even as the ecological story is also true. So just trying to honor the questioner's underlying kind of emotional experience. A couple more questions. This one is from Doug Conwell. I live in the Santa Fe area and have seen them thin live trees for managing fires, but it looks like they take out all these cut trees, leaving very little on the ground. And then bad erosion occurs when and if we get rain. What is the best practice with this? So could you speak to that very, like, if you're going to thin, should you leave the trees there?
I would say don't do the thinning project in the first place. It's not necessary. I mean, the whole premise behind it is thinning is going to stop high intensity fire from occurring, and somehow it's going to prevent high intensity fire. I mean, first of all, that's misplaced because high intensity fire is natural in these ecosystems. It's a natural component of these fire regimes, and a lot of species depend on it. But second, it usually doesn't reduce fire intensity, so it's not accomplishing the fire management purpose. I would say really, you know, focus on protecting homes, but don't do the thinning project in the first place. I'd much rather have that conversation than talk about, you know, how to reduce impacts of thinning. Great.
But that said, it's very important to have woody debris on the forest floor to prevent erosion, absolutely. Aside from the logging thing, but now you're seeing that it's very important to have those elements on the forest floor. Yeah. They really do hold in water and are a very important part of forest health.
Yeah, I agree. And just real quickly, it's actually really important wildlife habitat as well, those down logs. Yeah. But just to underscore, you know, the commenter is absolutely right. You know, those thinned areas oftentimes do have a lot of erosion because of all the ground disturbance from the logging machinery. And the winds will often whip through those areas and drive the flames more rapidly because you don't have as many trees to buffer the winds and actually act as a windbreak in essence. Denser stands of forest act as a windbreak against the winds that drive the flames. They also have a cooler, more moist microclimate because they have higher canopy cover. And so there's so many countervailing factors that make fires burn differently than we would assume, you know, just based on our intuitive sense of things. But I think your point, John, is absolutely right. You know, we want to be mindful of the emotional impact to people of areas that they know well, and if they have, you know, burned intensely, or if there's been a drought and a lot of the trees have died because of drought and native bark beetles. It is a real change, and it can be shocking to people. And I went through this myself. Before I started researching this over 20 years ago, I used to look at those areas and I was really upset. You know, I love forests and I would think, oh my God, that's loss, that's devastation. Yeah. I thought the same thing. And as I started to learn more, my aesthetic reaction to these areas completely changed. Now I look at it and I think, oh, that's wonderful, that's beautiful, because I know the life that it brings.
Yeah, I'm gonna get to a comment because this will allow me to riff off of this, but this one's from Damon Hansen. He says, I've seen similar aspen growth after big fires on the north rim of the Grand Canyon this May. And I just wanna say, and then we'll get to another question, that one of the things about fire is people love aspens. And the only reason aspens exist is because of the displacement of the forest that preceded them. Mm-hmm. Aspen have this intrinsic relationship to fire. So I think for everyone, especially in Colorado, where there are higher elevation forests that are being burned, know that by the end of the summer, hopefully there'll be aspen shoots in many of these places coming up. So that's just my reassurance. Here's another question from Paul Hughes. Last week, I hiked the southwest area of the Carson Iceberg Wilderness in the Sierras. Mm-hmm. Entering from the county line trailhead. Along the drive in, there were miles and miles of salvage logged forests. What, if any, are the regulatory limits to salvage logging, acreage limits, subject to administrative appeal, or are all salvage projects treated as emergency and expedited with little or no environmental review?
short answer is it's the latter. You know, so pretty much whatever environmental protections for trees and limits on logging or size of logging or clear cutting, anything that might exist in the forest plans on a given national forest, on forest plan after forest plan and region after region, those limits are basically waived after fire. It's a real problem. The public is generally cut out of the process in terms of comments and you know, objection, any kind of administrative, you know, review or process. Scientific analysis is short-circuited. And so often a lot of this is done through categorical exclusions and the public is cut out. It's a real problem. And so you'll see those sorts of massive post-fire logging projects oftentimes with very limited public participation or environmental analysis. We need to change that. In my view, we need to get the U.S. Forest Service out of the logging business, both with regard to commercial thinning and post-fire logging. And we really need to protect these forests, you know, much more like national parks.
Yeah, to echo Dick Hutto again, these severely burned forests are some of the last places we should be logging, given that their levels of biodiversity are, you know, equal to, if not greater than, old growth forests. They deserve the same protection.
Yeah. We'll get to maybe two or three more questions. This one's from Karen Weber. Can you please address the increasing movement of building and living in wilderness areas, i.e. the urban wildland interface? Okay. Is that also really an issue here in terms of good fire and bad fire? You want to take that first, Monica?
Yes, that's definitely something that we need to address, because more and more people are moving into the urban wildlife interface. Maybe Chad wants to answer that a little bit more.
Well, one thing I'll say just briefly is that we know that there are ways to build homes that are far, far more fire safe. We can also retrofit existing homes. I mean, frankly, we should stop building homes out of wood. We need to shift away from wood anyway for climate change mitigation. But there are also additional things. It's not just about whether the home burns. It's also about whether people and their animals get out safely, if they need to evacuate, if there's a fire nearby. And there are certain places that are just intrinsically risky, you know, on narrow ridges where there's only one route of ingress and egress. You know, we shouldn't be building communities there because it's just inherently risky. It's, you know, windswept, topographically inaccessible, really difficult to get in or out. And I've commented on new building proposals for huge developments in certain areas like that, that I think are just putting people in harm's way.
This one is from Adam Risson. He says, some proponents of active forest management assert there is a need to thin stands before conducting prescribed burns. Are there areas or circumstances where such an approach is scientifically sound?
I actually, from what I understand of the research, you get the same benefits from not thinning before prescribed burn compared with, as well as doing the prescribed burning. Again, this isn't really my area of expertise. I'm more wildlife focused, so I could probably answer questions about wildlife and wildlife responses to fires.
I saw a question earlier that I'm looking for about spotted owl. Here it is.
Great.
In the wake of last year's massive bighorn fire, this one's from Patrick Deal, in the Santa Catalina Mountains, just north of Tucson, Mexican spotted owl recovery is an issue. According to a major meta-analysis done in 2018, mixed intensity fires have a net positive effect, you spoke to this, for spotted owl populations, partly because the owls like to forage in burned areas. The local ranger district is using a 2012 owl recovery plan, which seems based on the assumption of a net negative effect from fires on spotted owls. What's your opinion on this issue?
Mm-hmm, yeah, we need to use the updated science, absolutely. So there's no question about it. And, you know, we have lots of proposed suggestions that we make about what you can do, certain areas around spotted owl centers, site centers that you would refrain from logging in. And what we found actually in the Sierra Nevada in our when we were doing our radio telemetry studies, and then this is borne out by other studies that have been done after hours, is that when that habitat is closer to the nest, sort of core nest roost areas, that's when they really like to use it. And so we sort of recommend about maybe 2 kilometers out from the core area that you refrain from salvage logging. And this, we think, is something that could really benefit spotted owls if we put those protections in place. And I think it's also important, you know, to go out there and do the monitoring and continue to do the science to see how spotted owls are responding to fires of different intensities in different parts of the country.
Yeah, you know, it's I've dealt with this issue here in the Southwest because Guardians had a long history of advocating for Mexican spotted owls. It's amazing how the agencies weaponize and demonize fire to perpetrate the myths that are hostile to fire. We've got just another minute or two. Maybe ask each of you to close with a thought about where does the fire debate go from here? And related to that, what's the one thing you think people should do to help change the debate and the trajectory of how we as humanity relate to fire?
Well, first of all, I think now we've all attended this webinar, and hopefully we can all go out and visit some burn forest ourselves and see for ourselves, and we can have that personal experience in the burn forest to really understand how amazing they are, and then you can tell other people, talk about it, encourage other people to go out and see for themselves as well. And I think one of the things we can do as a society is to just let the forest grow. It's called proforestation. It's something that's gaining some traction. Let the forest grow, and then you'll have enough of the forest that it can burn in different patches, different mosaics, and you can have across the whole landscape some areas that burn severely, some that burned 10 years ago, some that haven't burned in a long time. And all of this is going to provide for all the biodiversity that's natural and native in our forests. That would be my suggestion.
Thank you, Monica. Chad, closing words.
I agree with Monica. You know, get out into the snag forest and check it out. A couple of things. You know, spring is really good time. Spring and early summer, it's a great time to do it. I would recommend going in the early morning or just after the sun goes down. Most of the birds really kind of hunker down after kind of mid-morning and in the heat of the day in the late spring and summer. And obviously, you know, make sure you're not in an area that was post-fire logged. You know, look for those stumps. If it was, you're not going to get the same biodiversity. It's usually pretty desolate in those logged areas. And I would say this, you know, I think, you know, from a larger policy perspective, we really need to start shifting away from wood products for lumber, for biomass. You know, that's a really bad idea from a climate change perspective, as well as biodiversity. You know, it was a letter from over 200 climate scientists and ecologists to Congress last year that said we really need to start shifting away from wood consumption in the way that we're shifting away from fossil fuels in order to overcome the climate crisis, because we have to draw down that excess CO2 from the atmosphere. And the only effective way to do that is, in addition to moving away from fossil fuels, is protecting a lot more natural habitats, and especially carbon-rich habitats like forests.
That was a conversation with Dr. Chad Hansen and Dr. Monica Bond. She's a wildlife biologist and biodiversity advocate with the Wild Nature Institute. Chad Hansen is co-founder of the John Muir Project of Earth Island Institute and author of Smokescreen, Debunking Wildfire Myths to Save Our Forests and Our Climate. Hansen and Bond spoke to the Wild Earth Guardians on June 5, 2021. The moderator of this webinar was John Horning, Executive Director of the Wild Earth Guardians. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, TUCRadio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glöden. Thank you for listening.